Coach, I know you're trying to figure this all out on your own. You're investing in your own learning on your own time because you want to show up for your teachers in the best way possible. Building your coaching program is a huge challenge, and it's even more difficult when you're asked to know about literacy practices and how to support them. That's why I created the Confident Literacy Coach. This self-paced course gives you the knowledge, strategies, processes, and downloadable tools that you need to be confident in your coaching work every single day. The new update to the reading and writing modules includes information about literacy that will help you grow your school's practices and grow your students into skilled readers and writers. Check it out at confidentliteracycoach.com and stop reinventing the wheel. Have you felt like you've provided all the PD, you've facilitated all the PLCs, and you've had all the conversations, but your teachers are still stuck? If your teachers are resistant to instructional change or having trouble implementing new things, it might look something like this. They're still using outdated practices that we know don't work. They fight every PLC to cling to their favorite lessons or strategies. You see evidence of poor instructional methods everywhere despite having provided tons of PD in better practices. And kids aren't learning and the same kids are at the bottom of the data chart every single time. Does this sound familiar? To literacy coaches who are committed to helping students grow as readers and writers, this is especially frustrating. That's why I created a free webinar for literacy coaches, but really any coach can value from it. It's all about helping teachers embrace new practices and try out something new, even when they're not excited about it. We'll learn why teachers resist change, how to help teachers feel secure and ready to try something new, and my favorite strategies and methods to encourage choice while expecting and holding them accountable for trying new things. I'm so excited to share this information with you that I created a free download that you'll get when you grab the free pre-recorded webinar at buzzingwithmissb.com/shift. Grab it today. It's totally free and it will make such a difference in your coaching. Welcome to Instructional Coaching with Miss B, where we believe that every teacher deserves a coach and every coach does too. I'm Chrissy Beltran, an elementary teacher who became a coach, and I had to create my own coaching program that worked. Now I teach coaches how to design their coaching programs, build a school-wide action plan, and use differentiated strategies to support teachers. Plus, I've got a special spot in my heart for literacy coaches. Now let's dig into the episode. Hey, Coach, and welcome to episode 189 of Instructional Coaching with Miss B. Today, we are talking about reading and writing in the content areas, sometimes called writing across a curriculum or reading across a curriculum, why all coaches need literacy knowledge with Douglas Fisher. I am so excited today because my course is open. The Confident Literacy Coach is the one-stop shop for literacy coaches. It will teach you what to do with coaching and what to do with literacy. You can grab that at confidentliteracycoach.com. And it's open today. And if you already are on the list, the wait list, you will get an email about that. You can just click that link, jump right in. Okay. It's actually lots of lessons. It has so many resources that you can just download and you can use them for yourself or with your teachers. And it really gives you all the tools you need to just hit the ground running instead of like always trying to figure out what's wrong, what's not working. I'll tell you what works and you can use it. So that's at confidentliteracycoach.com. Grab that course because it is open now if you're listening in real time. And you can also, of course, grab my free webinar at buzzingwithmissb.com/shift. That's the Making the Shift webinar. If you are moving into science of reading or science of reading practices, this webinar is for you. It will help you get teachers on board and talk about what you need to do to help teachers embrace new learning. So check that out at buzzingwithmissb.com/shift. You're going to be happy that you did. Today, we're going to talk with Douglas Fisher about reading and writing in the content areas. Now, this is a cause that is near and dear to my heart. If you are a coach of math or science or just a general instructional coach, and you don't know how to help teachers integrate reading and writing and learning to read and learning to write through content areas all day long, then that can be a real struggle to get kids to grow in their literacy as well as in the content areas, because one of the ways that we learn things is by reading and writing about it. That's going to solidify that learning. So we're going to dig into some of the reasons that we've seen, you know, compartmentalized instruction, what school looks like when we really do build literacy all day long. And Douglas is going to share a little bit about one of his books, 50 Instructional Routines to Develop Content Area Literacy. So I'm so excited to dig into this conversation. So welcome, Douglas, to the podcast. I'm so glad that you could join us today.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, totally. So as a way to introduce yourself, I would love to hear about a few things. Can you tell us about who you help and how you spend most of your time and energy at work?
I mostly work with teachers these days. I used to mostly work with students. I'm out of high school right now. I really work to say to our teachers, you're amazing at what you do. Let's continue your journey of becoming amazing teachers. I work with colleagues, super dedicated, love what they do. And always, we're always on a quest to improve. I learn all the time. I learn from my colleagues. I learn with my colleagues. And I hope that the teachers I work with learn from me as well.
Excellent. I love that way of looking at it because that is the mission, right? We're always growing. Everybody deserves a coach and support to do that. I love that. Now, this is just a fun question, but some people find it the trickiest question of all. What is your go-to TV show or movie, your comfort show, or the one you watch over and over again?
That's a hard one because I'm not really a TV person.
A book person? You have a go-to book you reread?
No, once I have it, I have it. I do get kind of addicted to a TV show, but I don't like to have many because I don't catch up on them. I am a movie person. I do like to go to the movie and immerse myself in the big movies because I get too distracted at home. Like halfway through a movie, I'm up walking around and doing something else. So I like going to the movies. There's so many good movies out that tell amazing stories. I would probably say I'm more of a music person in the go-to place. So if I'm in the more 80s mood, I'm going to be in Depeche Mode. I admit after I saw Taylor Swift in concert, I became a little bit of Swiftie. I think she's a very talented artist. But I think there's so many people, so many artists out there that I just love hearing their songs and their music and playing it over again So it's a very, I think my go-to of that would be my phone with all the music on it.
Perfect. Yes, your beloved playlist that you tend to play over and
Yep,
over again.
yep,
Yeah,
yep.
your curated list. I love that. All right. So today we're talking about reading and writing in the content areas, or some say, reading and writing across the curriculum. And I think that this is an issue that kind of doesn't get enough attention, honestly,
Right.
because so many schools have really compartmentalized the way we teach, especially literacy. It's like, this is reading, this is writing, this is math. Everything's in little boxes. So even whenever they like, some people will say, oh, we're departmentalized. I teach reading in second grade. I teach writing, which is like wild
Yep.
to me. So, what are some of the consequences we're seeing of this compartmentalization?
So in one case, then people abdicate the responsibility and say, "Oh, I'm not a math teacher, so I don't have to do anything related to numbers, or I'm not a writing person, so I don't care if kids write, and spelling doesn't count." All of those kinds of messages to young people about it's someone else. The language is how human beings learn. We learn through language. We learn with language. All of us use language to communicate, to learn, to understand. So all of us are language workers. Yes, we also have content to teach, but we teach content through language, through reading, writing, speaking, listening, and viewing. Math, art, PE, all of that is learned through speaking, reading, writing, viewing, listening. And so I think that's a challenge when we see too much separation, that I am not that kind of teacher because if you're teaching social studies, you are still developing language. It's just language in social studies. I feel like reading has been, even though it's really popular to have conversations about reading in the elementary grades, especially in the primary grades, we are having all kinds of conversations about what it looks like for reading in the elementary primary grades. We're less comfortable having conversations around that with late elementary, fifth grade up through high school. We've been really working on, so the reading rope is very common in the primary grades. People talk about the reading rope and Hollis Scarborough's work. Even though it's really old, it's got a resurgence in people. It's a visual that resonates with people. But when you think about older kids, that's not really the right visual anymore. As she says, some of the strands become less critical, or as people who write about her work say, the strands become less critical, other strands become increasingly critical. So we've been talking about a model for older readers. What would it look like? And we're talking right now about like a little battery pack with a plug as a metaphor, and the plug is self-efficacy. The battery pack is filled with background knowledge, topical knowledge, and cultural knowledge. And then there are four kind of bars, if you will, as we think about it. Do the students recognize the word? Do they know what the word knowledge? Do they have sentence fluency? And then do they have verbal reasoning? So we're kind of processing through, like, what would a model be for older readers based on the evidence we have today?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that part of the issue is that whenever people talk about Scarborough's reading rope, I think they're talking about the parts maybe that they think they're less familiar with. So then they really focus on this word recognition piece. And then they kind of omit all the language comprehension piece, like you're talking about background knowledge and, you know, all these structures that we have to understand.
Right.
And they're missing out on that piece. So then it becomes less relevant as kids get older, because a lot of the kids who need those things are kids who didn't get them when they were younger, right? So mm-hmm. that we're filling in holes with those word recognition elements.
Right.
But the general kids, like the rest of the kids who need to keep moving forward as well, they're not stuck there, right? So
right.
we have to build on what they have as well. And so if we're only focusing on one component, or we're looking at how we can teach kids using that model at the exclusion of everything else, I think that is where we do see an issue as kids get older. We need to really dig into those language comprehension pieces and what that looks like at upper levels, I think.
Right. Great.
Yeah.
I was having a conversation with a group of high school teachers who were, you know, looking and saying, like, why were you talking about word recognition? And I said, well, there are some kids who need intervention, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the average classroom teacher and word recognition. So I did an example with them on sight words. Mm-hmm. And the perception of sight word recognition was high frequency words. And so I'm like, no, I'm not talking about your kindergarten word list. I'm talking about recognizing words at sight. Mm-hmm. And what is the instruction that would need to occur to recognize words at sight? And so what I said to them, and I'll say to you all, the word Vygotsky, most of us educators recognize the word Vygotsky at sight. We can say it, or the phonology, the orthographic mapping happens automatically. We have meaning for it. We talk about zone of proximal development, inner speech, social cultural theory. We activate a whole bunch of stuff by instantly seeing that word. If I went to my dentist probably would not know Vygotsky at sight. My dentist would probably stumble over the word, not recognize it, probably not activate phonology when reading that word, like having to kind of parse it apart or whatever. Because our sight word vocabulary continues to grow. And it grows in different content areas and disciplines. And that's, for me, word recognition. It continues throughout our life. We don't stop working on word recognition with our students.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. It's like those tier three words that we talk about that are very content specific, that you're not
right.
Like there are lots of words in any kind of dentistry text that I'm going to have to like really do some work on.
Yes.
You know, just to comprehend at a very, very superficial level.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So then whenever we are compartmentalizing all this learning, we're missing the opportunity to develop all of that background knowledge and those word connections and meanings and all the frameworks that kids need to comprehend at higher levels.
Right. Right.
So then what can school look like when we're doing a really good job of building literacy throughout the day? And what does that create? What opportunities does it create? What are the outcomes? You know, what is it like, this utopia?
I think every one of us needs to be thinking about literacy development and I would argue specifically some reading work that all of us have to be doing, having students in complex texts with high quality instructions, where students are building their self-efficacy, where they're saying, oh, when I put forth this effort and I have this goal, I actually learn more. We have to be recognizing background knowledge, topical knowledge, you know, cultural knowledge, and developing that. We have to be thinking about, how do I improve their reading, then their overall literacy? And I think, so I appreciate the disciplinary literacy conversations. I recognize scientists think differently than historians, and we need to get kids into that kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. But we also have to continue their reading development, that more generic reading development. And our field tends to go in these either or dichotomies. So we either have disciplinary literacy or we have content area reading. It's both. Both are important. And as the texts get harder, we have to help students understand those texts. As Lily Wong Filmer talked about, those juicy sentences, take apart that sentence and really understand what it's doing. As you were saying earlier, the language comprehension, verbal reasoning continues to grow, and we have to think through that. Understanding the referent, you know, why did they say it? What is the it referring back to or forward to? So there's all kinds of work we need to be doing with young people. When we do it, I think their confidence grows as well as their competence grows. And it's pretty rewarding to feel success. And I know we can learn from failure. I know we say, you know, we learn from failure, we learn from mistakes. It is true. We can learn. We do learn from failures and mistakes. But our brain really likes to learn from success. Success feels amazing. It floods that reward pathway. It feels great. No one likes the feeling of failure. No one likes being wrong. Yes, we learn from it. But imagine if we could get our young people to be able to learn from their successes as well as their mistakes. Like we plan experiences where they experience that success and it reinforces the reward pathway. And they start to say, I want to do that again because that felt good. I'm actually good at this. We had a student, a quick example. We have a student who came in at ninth grade and did not read. I mean, really, really like CVC words, did not read them. And his reading teacher yesterday came up to me and said, you won't believe what he just said in front of a whole bunch of kids and peers and teachers. Now, he used to go hide and make sure no one saw him get any kind of extra help from the reading specialist. But yesterday, in front of a whole group of kids, he said, Miss Ortega, I can read words now and not just the little ones. And the level of pride and like, I am a ninth grader and I'm publicly saying this now. And I just, how that must feel. And now he wants to start doing a little video recording about telling high schoolers, don't be embarrassed if you can't read, because there are things you can do to learn. And so we're going to record him on a little video explaining his thinking now. And that's the kind of thing that feeds us. That's the kind of thing that's like, we did that. And I don't know why he didn't know how to read before ninth grade. I don't know what happened to him in his life. However, it was super embarrassing and he had repeated failure. And you can imagine the behavior when you want to hide the fact that you can't read.
Yeah, absolutely. My husband was asking about that the other day because we have a kindergartner who's a pretty fluent reader, you know, and she was my daughter and she was reading aloud. And my husband said, so does this develop reading? I said, well, we're just listening to her read because we like to listen to her read right now. But I said, imagine if you're on a bike and you already know kind of the basics of how to ride a bike and you're okay at it and you keep practicing and you get better at it. So, well, now imagine you're on a bike and you have no clue how to ride a bike. And every time you fall off, I just say, well, get back on the bike because you're never going to figure it out if you don't get back on there.
Right.
I don't teach you those pieces that you're missing. If I don't help you develop those skills, I mean, some people have like this natural ability, but most people, like just like in reading, most people do not.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got to have that skill set developed for your practice to be purposeful or else you're just failing all the time and you never want to ride a bike again.
You know? Yeah. I love what you're saying. So this is part of my mission in life. Instruction has to be strong. It has to be effective. It has to be growth producing. And we need to give students practice. Simply saying that they should go practice things, writing or reading or the piano, is not going to make them better. And the phrase that we say all the time is practice makes perfect. It's not true. Practice makes permanent. Yeah. And so I really appreciate, yes, we like listening to her read, but that's not what's making her a better reader. There's a practice effect so that what she has been taught has a chance of sticking.
Yes.
And I unfortunately see classrooms where the instruction's amazing. It's so good. I would be honored to be in that room. But those kids never engage in practice. And so it's an uphill battle for the teacher because if they're not engaged in sufficient practice, the learning doesn't stick.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that's the benefit of reading and writing all day long is they get practice all mm-hmm. throughout the day.
Yep.
I saw huge gains. I did years ago, I was a member of the National Writing Project, the local site. And that was one of the things that we were talking about was writing across a curriculum. And it was such, once I started really being thoughtful about that and making sure my kids were having structured and purposeful opportunities to write throughout the day, they're writing. The teachers next year said, keep doing what you're doing. We've never had writers this good.
Awesome.
And yeah, it was a huge shift for me. And I was like, yeah, well, I mean, I always kind of did it, but not to that degree. And it made such a difference just being more purposeful about it. But so then this is kind of what I'm interested in. You're talking about in your book, 50 instructional routines to develop content area of literacy. I feel like one of the issues is people kind of don't know, where do we spend our time doing this? Like, what can this even look like?
Yeah.
So you have some really specific practices that teachers can use in the content areas. And I'm curious about how you went about choosing them. How do you know which are the 50 that were going to be the most
great question. So the criteria we use, there had to be evidence of research, like that people have studied this and said, this has the potential to improve learning. So in at least some studies, it did do that. Second criteria, it had to be used in multiple content areas. So it wasn't specifically a science or a math. It had to have effectiveness in multiple content areas. Perhaps not all the content areas. We couldn't find ones that, you know, every content area, but it wasn't isolated to a specific kind of learning. These were more generic approaches that have evidence and could be transparent and transportable. What we were trying to do is say, if you want to build habits with kids, they need to experience these things. You don't want to get them bored, but you also want to be able to build some habits with them from class to class to class to class. And that's what our criteria was. So, and it was fascinating to watch, you know, what didn't make it. Very isolated strategies only in one content or discipline, or strategies that people talk about for which there was no published evidence that they made a difference. So that's where we try to narrow the list down. We could have come up with more than 50. The publisher kind of said, that's all the pages you get. But there are actually a few more than that. And then we started thinking about, where do they apply? Did we balance between things that the teacher would do before a text or during a text? So we tried to look at some different ways to think about the organization. We ended up putting them together alphabetically because people could find, we decided you could find them faster if you alphabetically, but there's all kinds of ways to like sort and resort them. One of the things I do is I give people a little index cards with different reading strategies. And I have them sort them. Like, how would you use these before a text? How would you use these after a text? Mm-hmm. How would you have students engage on their own with these versus what requires teacher instruction? So I have them do different word sorts with these cards to help them develop some flexibility in how they think about instructional routines.
I like that. I love sorts. I love doing word sorts during a professional development. Yep. It's one of my favorite things to do. Mm-hmm. Can you think of one offhand that was one that people talk about a lot but didn't make the cut because it wasn't actually research? There was no research to support it?
Gosh, that was a while back. There were some writing approaches, like acronyms for writing. You all can Google them. There's acronyms for writing that just haven't had published research behind them. Like, here's a little model of writing, a little hamburger model or whatever.
Yeah.
That just don't have evidence for them, behind them. And then there are some that we almost put in there, like these are malpractice. It's still unfortunately common practice to do round robin reading. You know, like one kid read and then count ahead. Yep. I still see this. And there's no evidence that that's a good idea. No. One of the challenges around choral reading, when done well, choral reading actually has a positive effect on learning. Mm-hmm. It probably is this impress in our brain when we're saying and hearing other people read. But when done poorly, it doesn't have any effect at all. So we were careful about that when we didn't put choral reading in because we were a little worried that the risk of doing it incorrectly and having no effect was greater than specifics. Some were super easy, like reciprocal teaching. There are so many studies out about reciprocal teaching. There are good effect sizes. That's easy. Like everyone knows that. Jigsaw, easy. That there are lots of studies that show the effectiveness of jigsaw.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention round robin and choral reading, because just the other day, whenever we were having this conversation, we really were talking about this, I promise. My husband said, well, what about, like, is it a good thing whenever the teacher will go, like our teachers used to do, you know, how they would do like round robin. I said, well, what would you do during round robin reading? Because he was, you know, an English language learner, first generation, and was not a huge fan of school when he was little or at any point, really. He said, well, I would count all the kids in front of me and I'd figure out what my paragraph was. I said, yeah, how much did that really do for you? Like, was that really? He was like, yeah, no, it didn't do anything. I was just wondering why they did it. I said, they did it because they didn't know what else to do. And they thought it kept you on your toes.
Right. You know? And especially when they call kids on randomly.
That's so you what don't, he said.
Can't count ahead.
Popcorn. Yes, popcorn reading. He goes, well, what really got me was popcorn reading. I said, well, what would happen? He's like, well, I just wouldn't know. I wouldn't be ready.
Yep.
That was all, you know.
There are some very funny TikTok videos of young adults talking about the trauma of popcorn reading and round robin reading.
Yes.
I've been collecting some of these for teachers because, oh, they're one of the kids like, and I didn't say the word medieval right. I know the word medieval, but I froze up. And then and I'm like, it's so funny because they're doing these like these confessions on TikTok around.
Right.
Yeah, now they're in their 20s and they're having these confessions of round robin reading and popcorn reading.
Yes, I can remember 2 times kids in my classroom mispronouncing words. And I was mortified for them because I was like, oh my gosh, I would be so embarrassed right now. It's not a big deal, but I would feel embarrassed, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember the word was cupboard and he said cupboard. And another word, I was already in high school, and the word was Barbados, and she said Barbados. Like, how would they know those, you know?
Right. It's a logical one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then choral reading, I would love, could you share a little bit about what makes choral reading work and what doesn't make it work? Because I've seen it done, like you're saying, well and poorly.
So a first read on a text is probably not a good idea for choral reading. Mm-hmm. So it's a previewed or practice piece of text. They probably have some discussion about it before they do the choral read about it. So they have a general understanding of what's happening in the text. That's going to increase the likelihood that choral reading is effective. Mm-hmm. If there are kids who really struggle with that first read, it's probably not going to do much good for them to do the choral read. When it's previewed in practice and when they have a general understanding of it, mm-hmm. and there's a routine. So the routine is, like, depending on your aid, are you following your finger? Are you only using your eyes?
Yeah.
When there's a routine that they interact with, there's probably, we think there's probably this impress that's happening in our brain. We're seeing the words, we're hearing the words, we're producing the words. And so it does build fluency. It might accelerate your fluency a little bit more than you read on your own. So it's kind of a little accelerator. So it's really interesting to watch when teachers build a habit of a choral read where it's previewed and practiced, there's a conversation or some amount of understanding, at least at the literal level, and then there's a read out loud and then followed up with a task. So either a vocabulary task or a writing task. Then you're going to see the effect of choral reading go way up.
Thank you so much for clarifying that. I love that. Okay, do you have a few favorite routines is what I would love to know about? Because I'm sure there are some that really stood out to you that you're like, I love it when I see this in action.
Some of the high utility ones I still love seeing. Reciprocal teaching and jigsaw are among my favorite go-tos. I love to take a piece of paper and fold it into quadrants and fold the middle down. So I have 4 quadrants and a rhombus in the middle. And then have students write their own notes in that first upper left quadrant. That's where my notes go. And then have a conversation. And when other people talk, they take notes in the other quadrants. I really like that because it shows them you're accountable for what other people say, even if you don't agree with them. I think there's a lot of vocabulary strategies. One of my colleagues did a book on vocabulary strategies, 50 vocabulary strategies. I believe kids satiate on vocabulary strategies. They get bored with vocabulary. It's like the coolest thing ever for 2 weeks and they don't ever want to do it again.
Yeah, for sure.
So we do need a lot of vocabulary strategies because word learning is super important. Knowing that knowledge of the words is really important. So I think we have to change that up every once in a while to make sure students are still paying attention to the words. We talked about word sorting. I like self-collection strategies of vocabulary. I still like a Frere model card where they put the word, what it means, what it doesn't mean in an illustration or sentence. I still think there's some processing time that's good. Mm-hmm. So I like seeing students interact with the text and what the teacher does to get them into that text, eyes on the text more and more minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's so important. Yeah, that's the practice component that you're talking about, right? Building that opportunity to come back to the text, to practice all the things that they've been learning in the context of a text, and then to write about it.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that. So if people want to grab your book, where can they find it? And also—
Probably Amazon's easiest.
Okay.
Probably Amazon's the easiest.
That's 50 instructional routines to develop content area literacy. And then is there anything, any other place that people can learn from you? Your website, social media, anything like that.
So I still have Twitter X, D Fisher SDSU. That's a great way to connect with me. I I send stuff out almost every day, things I'm thinking about. Website, Fisher and Fry. Her last name is Frey. Should be Frey, but it's Fry. Fisherandfry.com is another way. We put all of our resources up there, all kinds of PowerPoints and things we write for there.
That's awesome. That could be such a great place for coaches to go who are providing professional development to their schools to build the repertoire strategies and the understanding of content area literacy as well.
Yep.
So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation and the conversation. I really appreciated it.
You know, you can probably tell when you're listening, some of these guest conversations just absolutely fly by. And my conversation with Douglas Fisher just flew by because I want to get back in the classroom and do all of these fun things. And I just really enjoyed chatting with him. He's a real person. And I swear that conversation I had with my husband just happened last week. This is wild. And we did talk about choral reading and round robin. And this is what we talk about at home. He's a history guy, loves history, and I'm an education person. And these are the conversations that we have because we're just a couple of nerds. Okay, so I want to make sure that you remember you can grab that Making the Shift webinar if you're trying to get to move your teachers into embracing content area practices. It's got some great ideas to help you do that. That's buzzingwithmissb.com/shift. And please do not forget, the Confident Literacy Coach is open. You can grab it at confidentliteracycoach.com. Next week, I'm going to continue our series on better instruction, and we're going to deep dive into math and what math classrooms can look like and how to make them happen. So we're going to talk to my guest, Christian Acosta, next week. And until then, happy coding. Now that you've got so much to think about, head over to buzzingwithmissb.com to grab some free downloads, become a VIB, and check out the podcast show notes. Happy coaching!